Bible scholars have noted that if all the writings of the New Testament had been destroyed, we still would have, in three chapters of the Bible, the total message of Jesus' teaching. And those three chapters are what we usually call the Sermon of the Mount. And they are Matthew verses 6, 5, 6, and 7. And the Sermon on the Mount really brings into one lesson, in one three-chapter lesson, the essential teachings of all of Jesus' ministry. And oh, what practical, wonderful teachings they are. They really show us how to navigate our lives as spiritual beings having a human experience. These are principles that can enrich our lives and help us create a spiritual kingdom right here on this earth. Now, as the law of Moses, received on Mount Sinai, is considered to be the heart of Judaism, it is the Sermon on the Mount that is considered to be the heart of Christianity. And you all will remember the original law was handed down to Moses on the mountain on Sinai, and it was accompanied by thunder and lightning. But the new law was articulated by Jesus on a beautiful grassy summit overlooking the Sea of Galilee. And today we're going to begin a series of lessons focused on the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, what are commonly called now the Beatitudes. Now the word beatitude, those of you who took Latin, I may not be pronouncing this right, from the Latin word beatus, meaning comes to be happy. And Unity minister Charles Roth wrote that if Jesus were alive today and renaming these in English, he would probably call them keys to happiness. And of course, we know always that in Bible study, correct translations are really important. And if you've ever tried to translate a language from one to the next, if you've ever tried to do it orally or even in text, you know the difficulties. Multiple meanings of words, idiomatic expressions that don't make much sense once they're translated, nuances of meaning. I did an internet search this week on humorous mistranslations, and I'd like to share a few with you. From a hotel in Acapulco, the manager has personally passed all the water here. From an airline ticket counter in Copenhagen. We take your bags and send them in all directions. That's happened to me, probably happened to you. From an Italian cemetery, I love this one. Persons are prohibited from picking flowers from any but their own graves. And from a cocktail lounge in Norway, ladies are requested not to have children at the bar. And last but not least, from a hotel in Japan, you are invited to take advantage of the chambermaid. So all well-intended, but just choosing the wrong synonym, right, when you translate. So in 2,000 plus years of translations, from the oral Aramaic originally, to the Greek, to the Latin Vulgate, into German, into French, and into English, mistranslations abound in the Bible. And today we're going to highlight some of them in the first two Beatitudes. Now our sources for understanding this powerful message from Jesus include the same ones we looked at for the Lord's Prayer, because the Lord's Prayer is the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Today we're going to look at the beginning. And they are from Eric Butterworth, Discover the Power Within, Meditations on the Mount by Ed Townley, Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, and one additional one, and these are the archived lessons of Charles Roth, simply called the Beatitudes. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is reported in both Matthew and Luke, although there are striking differences. Luke's is much shorter, and Matthew places the Sermon on the Mount at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. Luke places it much later. And in our series, we'll be focusing mainly on Matthew, but I'll talk a little bit about how it differs from Luke. So Matthew sets the stage at the end of chapter 4 by describing the multitude that is already following Jesus. And he says, Jesus went through Galilee, It's around the Sea of Galilee. Jesus went through Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and sickness among the people. So his fame spread throughout all of Syria, and they brought to him all the sick, and he cured them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee to the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and in and beyond the Jordan. Now, listen carefully to the next part, because now we're really into the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, and this might differ from the picture in our heads. So listen carefully to this part. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, and we'll talk about what he says in a moment, but the common picture that many of us have of Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount is that he's in the midst of this multitude, this huge crowd, and he's teaching right in the midst of them. But Matthew tells us differently. He says that Jesus has been with the multitudes, and then he departs. He takes his disciples and goes up the mountain. This is a difference from Luke. Luke says it takes place on the plains below, and actually Luke's version is not called the Sermon of the Mount, it's called the Sermon of the Plains. So that's one place where you see the differences. But metaphysically, a mountain always represents a higher consciousness, a state of spiritual realization. So maybe Jesus felt the need to go up and just become centered in all of the divine power of God and to help his disciples do so before he began this really, really important lesson. Now, Matthew tells us also that once he's at the peak, he sits down, perhaps on one of the large boulders on the hillside. There's a picture, an accurate picture of him sitting down. And his disciples gather around him. Now, this follows the Jewish tradition that a great teacher would have always been sitting, and his followers or disciples would have been at the teacher's feet. The entire Gospel of Matthew, we kind of need to understand about audience here. Matthew writes his entire gospel for a Jewish audience. He is trying to convince his fellow Jews, the Hebrew people, that Jesus really is the Messiah prophesied in the Old Testament. And therefore, he uses every single opportunity to make connections between what Jesus is saying and what is in the Old Testament. And this is just one of these places. So the important thing is, when Jesus begins his lesson, I invite all of us now to just join Jesus on that hilltop. For clearly, those profound words of Jesus were not just meant for his disciples, they were meant for generations to follow, and truly they are meant for us today. And so just picture yourself sitting on that hillside, the sun is shining, a breeze is caressing your face. Perhaps you sit down on one of those boulders and lean in so that you can hear the words of Jesus to take in every single idea into your hearts. Ed Townley reminds us, we are not standing on the fringes of a large crowd. We are seated at the foot of the Master, part of a small and select group, and we can easily hear every gentle, powerful word. And Jesus begins saying, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Once again, Jesus is referring back to the prophets of the Old Testament. Now, these short poetic statements, so concise and so pithy and so beautifully written, are radically different from the old law. The Interpreter's Bible says the Beatitudes are jets of light and love kindled against the darkness of the age. And notice, instead of all the thou shalt nots that the people were used to, we repeatedly hear the beautiful blessed are. Blessed are. Now, blessed comes from the Greek word makarios, and it means a self-contained happiness or sense of bliss within, self-contained. And Charles Fillmore tells us that blessed means to invoke or call upon good, to call forth the action of God. So in contrast to the Ten Commandments, the Beatitudes are not about actions to follow or to avoid following, but they are about what we sometimes call attitudes of being. They are about consciousness, in other words. They are about not conforming to prescribed dogma, but transforming our minds, claiming the spiritual power of our divine inheritance. Now, we all know that Jesus had very little patience with the Jewish priesthood and its theory of salvation by outer acts and rules and rituals. This reminds me of a story, my favorite story about rules. It happened to one of my daughters of one of my friends. Her name was Colleen, and she was the youngest in her family, and she was so excited about starting school. I mean to tell you, every single day, the summer before kindergarten, she would say to my friend, her mom, oh, it's today the day, I get to go to school, and she was just so excited. And on that very first day, she got up an hour early, she had her clothes on, she'd had her breakfast, she was sitting on the bench on the front porch like an hour before the school bus came, just so excited. But when she came home that night, and my friend said to her, her mom said to her, well, how was it, Colleen? She said, oh, Mommy, I thought we'd color and learn to read and play games, and all they talked about all day long was wools, wools, wools. Too many wools for her. And I think, you know, Jesus would have agreed with her that there were too many rules. And he would say that, too, of the Jewish priesthood. So with that in mind, let us look at the first attitude of being today. Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, traditionally, this has been interpreted to mean that poverty is a virtue, that those who suffer from lack in this world will somehow gain access to a future kingdom in the next. You know, the God love the poor, that's why he created so many of them mentality. Does that sound like the Jesus who said, I have come so that you should have life and have it abundantly? I don't think so. Jesus is not idealizing poverty here. The word poor in this context has nothing to do with lacking wealth or goods. It simply means empty. It means empty. And poor in spirit does not mean, as some have suggested, those who are spineless, complacent, or lazy. The root that is translated spirit comes from the word ruach, which is more accurately translated pride or personal will. So Jesus is saying here, blessed, happy, in bliss are you who are empty of false pride, empty of personal will, and empty of your precious possessions. For sometimes, isn't it true, we all take pride in our possessions, do we not? We do for a while, until one day, eventually they get carted off to the parking lot sale, right? I mean, what we wanted so much and what we thought would make us so happy doesn't usually last. But most of all, Jesus is saying to us, I believe, in this beatitude, that we need to be empty of preconceived opinions and beliefs. Empty of the, you know it all, and I can do it all through my personal will consciousness. In my former career, I trained new teachers. And, you know, in this day and age, good teaching jobs are really hard to get, and the competition is, it's very competitive. And so the ones who actually landed contracts were very bright. They came from the best colleges. You know, they were well-trained. But you know what my worst problem was with a few of them? Can you guess? Those who thought they knew it all. Never had stepped into a classroom except for student teaching, but boy, they thought they knew it all. And what is the problem with thinking we know it all? Are we open? No, we don't have to be open. We have all the answers. And so I think it's really important, and this is what Jesus is talking about. When we think we know it all, we're not open to new ideas. We're not open to new understandings. And sometimes it's only when we realize that we don't have all the answers, all the solutions, that then we turn from the challenges of the world to rely on God and to activate the powers of our indwelling Christ. Has that ever happened to you? You struggle and struggle and struggle, and then when you say, okay, I can't do this, you let go and let God, it just unfolds in perfect divine order. So interestingly, the message of Jesus' ministry was best received by the simple and unlettered people. In order to understand this, we need just a little bit of historical perspective. The Jewish religion of the time had a definite caste system. The scribes, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees were from the wealthy, ruling, educated class. And it was believed by everyone, both classes, that they were better than the farmers, the fishermen, the tradesmen, and the craftsmen. Superior not only in possessions and wealth, but they believed that they were spiritually superior also. But because they had followed all the rules, if you will, in the Torah. And not only did they follow all of those rules, they added a heap of their own. They did. Dietary laws, commandments about cleanliness, rules about eating, and rituals about worship. Would anybody like to take a guess of how many rules the Pharisees and Sadducees tried to follow in one day? Let's hear some numbers. What do you think? 150,000, not 1,000, but a modern rabbi who's researched the whole Old Testament tells us that the number of rules to be followed was way more than 600. 600 rules a day. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes I struggle with the five principles. How in the world does anybody follow 600 rules a day, especially the lower class? Because they were working from dawn to dusk. They didn't have time to learn all these rituals, much less to engage in them. And nor could they afford all the religious garments and the things that were needed to worship. And therefore, it was accepted by everyone of the time that the Sadducees and Pharisees were more religious, closer to God, superior in their faith. And the common people were considered, guess what? Sinners, religious outcasts. And here comes Jesus. Here comes Jesus sitting on that hillside saying, blessed are you, happy are you, in bliss are you who are not mentally tied to all of the rules and rituals of man-made religion. Fortunate are you who can feel your own personal connection to God. Fortunate are you who can remain open to the inflow and outflow of all God's goodness. What you thought was your religious poverty is what sets you free. You are free to listen to my teachings, receptive to think about them, and be open to new understandings about the power of God in and through your life. It was truly revolutionary teaching. And let us not forget the second part of the first beatitude, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. We all know that Jesus taught again and again that the kingdom of heaven is within, absolutely. And the word heaven comes from the Greek word that means expanding. So Jesus is talking about the expanding potential, the expanding spirituality within each one of us. So the glorious promise of this first beatitude is that when we release our human will, when we open our minds and hearts to all God is, success is guaranteed. God is there always. And in fact, Ed Townley says, and I love this quote, there's no chance of failure because God is eternally seeking us even more than we are seeking God. Isn't that beautiful? And that leads us perfectly into the second beatitude. Blessed are they who mourn, for they will be comforted. Now, we might not think of our sad times, our trials and tribulations on this earth as blessings, do we? And yet it is true that sometimes our needs and life challenges cause us to turn to God. Certainly when we experience loss, when we're mourning for a loved one, we do find healing and comfort in the unconditional love of God. But just as the healing power of spirit is at work when we cut our finger or break a bone, that same healing power is at work in us when we're in grief, when we experience sadness. And in all things, the more we know our oneness, the more we are comforted, and the more we align ourselves with the strength and power within. Also like a broken bone, sometimes it becomes stronger after healing, and sometimes we emerge from our bad times and from our grief in a clear understanding of the power and presence of God. Now, I want to make sure that we understand none of this means that a God of love sends us pain and heartache, but it does mean that when pain and heartache occur in this plane of existence, God is always there, always. And as wonderful as this message is, when we study the original language, we do realize that the master metaphysician, Jesus Christ, had an even deeper meaning. And we can figure out what that is once again when we look at the original meaning of the words. In the Aramaic, the word mourn means to be mindful, to yearn, to be passionate or eager for something. And so, very interestingly, the word comfort is a combination of come, meaning intensive, and forte, as you musicians will know, meaning strong. So this attitude of being might be translated as blissful, blessed, fortunate are you who yearn for God, for you shall discover the strength of Christ. And I think the best story I know that illustrates this yearning for God piece is one that I bet a lot of you have heard. It's of an Eastern story about a young man who travels miles and miles to seek out a spiritual teacher who he is told has all the answers of the universe. And he finally finds this teacher, and he finds him in a river. So the young seeker goes up to the teacher, and he says, "Oh, I have traveled so far. Help me, help me. I want to find God." And without a word, the teacher grabs the young man and with remarkable strength shoves his head down under the water and holds it there for a long time. The young man is struggling and trying to break free, and he cannot. And finally, I mean, with not a second to spare, the teacher grabs the young man's head and pulls him up. And he's sputtering, and he's gasping, and he stumbles to the shore. And the teacher, and very calmly, with all this centered peace, says to the young man, "What were you thinking of, son, when your head was underwater?" And the young man says, thinking, I was only thinking of one thing. I was only thinking of air. The only thing I wanted in this whole world was one breath of air." And some of you know the punchline. The old master looked at him and said, "Son, when you want God as much as you want air, you will find God and God will find you." Beautiful story about just what we're here on this earth for, really, is to just become closer to God and to know God. And the beauty is, when we seek first the kingdom, everything else we want falls into place, because that is what divine order is all about. So, when Jesus tells us, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted," maybe he is saying, fortunate, happy, blissful are we when we want nothing more than to know God, to experience the presence of Spirit within us, and to live our lives as God's expression on this earth. This is our comfort, this is our strength, and this is our power. So perhaps these two Beatitudes, and we'll look at the others later, but perhaps these two Beatitudes, revolutionary as they were at the time Jesus spoke these world-shattering words 2,000 years ago, can be just as life-changing and immediate for us today as we consider what attitudes of being are keys to happiness and our spiritual fulfillment. What is it that I want to be and what is it that I want not to be? That is the question. And so let's just take this into our hearts, this important question into our hearts about being, as we first of all affirm the truth about the being of God. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God the good, omnipotent, and so it is.